This is a Marketplace special podcast. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We have been out on the road this year, New York, Chicago, Houston, Washington, D.C., with a live roadshow we called How We Learn to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers, a celebration to mark the 25 years that we have been on the air, January 2nd, 1989, to be exact. Our last stop was here in our hometown, Los Angeles, and the evening is something you don't want to miss.
This is not going to be our typical roadshow. We're going to do something a little different tonight. We're going to have a couple of conversations, two conversations, actually, about a key part of our economy, first of all, and also how we at Marketplace do what we do. We're going to talk about, as the billing says, the business of creativity, but also creativity in business, which is similar but a slightly different thing. We're going to start with television. Two people from television, from the world specifically of television comedy. Although, and I suppose I ought to ask him this, I think you could safely say it's from the world of social commentary as well, based on what they do. Norman Lear has been around, absolutely. He has been around approximately forever. He's been around television since almost the birth of the medium. He certainly shaped it as we know it today. You know him, of course, best, I'm sure, from All in the Family, but that is not, it turns out, the favorite of his shows, and we'll talk about that in just a couple of minutes. He is 92 years old. He has spent the last six of those years writing his memoir. It is called Even This I Get to Experience. Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Lear.
Yo!
Wherever you want to sit, you pick your seat.
Where is she sitting?
Well, that, tell you what, we'll put her there, we'll put you there.
Okay.
All right? Guest number two, Amy Poehler. You're going to have to do this again when she comes out, you know, right? Or you don't. I don't know, Amy. I don't know how you feel about that. If you have watched comedy on television in the past 13 years, you have seen her. You've seen her on Saturday Night Live. You've seen her on Parks and Rec for the past 7 years, shooting, by the way, their seventh and last season this year right now for NBC. She was in production, I think, all day today, so be nice to her because she's probably exhausted. She also, by the way, even though she's less than half of Norman's age, has also written a book. It is number one, as Deb said, on the New York Times bestseller list. It is called Yes, Please, Amy Poehler.
Hello, Kai. Thank you. Hi.
Okay. There's always that awkward first onstage handshake. Hi, good, how are you?
You slipped me $20. Thank
well,
you
know,
that.
Whatever. Whatever it takes. Was that enough?
We'll see.
We should start with a disclosure, right? You guys know each other. There is a mutual admiration
society.
Do we
know each other?
Right?
Yes.
You have called All in the Family the best show on television ever.
I think so. My son's name is Archie.
I wanted to ask you about that. That had nothing really to do with it.
Well, I just have such affection for the name. I really do. And All in the Family, I think, is the best show in my lifetime that's ever been, comedy that's ever been on television.
How do you guys know each other? How'd you meet?
Norman and I met at an event. I did a bit on stage that you commented on that you liked, and I said, "Can I come over to your house?"
It was 36 years ago.
Yes, that's right. She was eight, but that's a whole different thing.
That's right.
No, but Amy is one of those people you know a little while and you feel you've known all your life.
Yeah,
it's
been like 20 minutes for me, so I'm good.
Yeah,
I'm good. You know, right? You know that saying, you can never step in the same stream twice, right? That the water's always moving. I wonder if a way to start might be to ask you guys if you think you are in the same business. You from 40 years ago and you from today. Amy, what do you think?
Well, honestly, I'm truly honored to be sharing the same stage, let alone the same business with Norman. But yes, I do think we are in the same business. I think we both like and find the same things funny from what I've gotten to know about getting to know Norman. And when you read Norman's story,
yeah,
in his book, there's nothing about it that felt not completely current,
yeah,
to everything that is my experience in television today. Although, I mean, everything is different, but everything also feels
right.
very much the same.
Do you recognize what she does in your chosen medium?
She does everything I thought we were doing. I'm talking about Amy Poehler. I'm not talking about the business at the at the moment. I'm talking about she's a great comedian and actress. And and there's a nobility about people with that kind of talent. And I look at her that way. And I'm thrilled to be sharing this stage with her. Enough of that horseshit.
Enough of that horseshit. There you go.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Thank you, Norman.
we're done now. Do you think, Norman, that the men mostly that you were with in the business in the 50s and 60s would acknowledge the changes that have come to American television and American comedy today, and social commentary as you guys do it?
I don't know. I have this question for Amy. Most of the men and women, most of them are men running shows, showrunners, and a handful of women. They tell me a lot of what we did, they couldn't get on the air today.
Yeah, and I agree.
So I'm not current in the way you and they are.
Network shows.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
They sit and talk to a network executive and said, but they did this 35 years ago. What do you mean we can't do it?
Although, I mean, you tell a lot of stories in this book, Norman Lear, On Sale in the Lobby, about your fights with network executives. I mean, you were going to quit. I can't even tell you how many times, not just over All in the Family, but so many more of them. You don't hear about those fights today.
But they exist, I'm sure.
I don't know, Amy, do
they?
I don't
know.
Do you think?
I haven't been a party to that kind of frontline courage, frankly, where someone has said, I quit. I would quit if you don't let me do this joke.
Like, it's the root of the creative process, right?
I think because there's a lot of different outlets for television now, there's a lot of different places for you to share your voice and get your stuff on. People who want to be a bit more provocative know that they have a place and a home in cable. And when Norman was working in network television, everybody was watching the same show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for an audience that honestly you'd probably die for today.
Yeah.
No, just straight numbers.
Yeah. I'd be excited for 1/100th of that audience.
You say at a couple of points in your book, Amy, that creativity for you comes out of chaos. What does that mean?
I'm going to say I didn't say that.
All right. Maybe somebody said it on your behalf, because just for the record, there are some guest writers in this book.
Yes. But to make it clear, my improv background, I liked the idea of not really quite knowing what was coming next.
Yeah.
But I find, as a person having worked with many other different people, I don't like people who create chaos for no reason. I tend to find that very, in my opinion, very talented people are also usually pretty functional bosses.
Right.
I have a really great boss in Michael Schur who runs Parks and Recreation. So I don't yearn for the person that likes to tip over the apple cart just because. But I will certainly go to battle with anybody who is a good leader, a benevolent captain.
Explain the yes please in this title, because it is about your improv background.
Yes, it is based on it briefly. There's a saying in improv, yes and, which is when you do a scene with someone and someone says, hey, we're... here we are at the dentist's office, and you don't go, no, we're not, and eat the sandwich. you say, yes, and I cannot wait to get my wisdom teeth pulled out so I can get that nitrous finally. it's based off of that idea, but yes, please came from the idea that yes is a word that I have said throughout my life, and it's gotten me where I am, and the please is added later because as I've gotten older, I've realized you don't do many things alone.
Yeah.
And it's a real privilege to even be asked.
I want to ask you, Norman, about dealing with talent. dealing with the people who have to take your creative idea and put it out there. And I want to ask specifically about your relationship with Carol O'Connor, who, of course, played Archie Bunker on your show. And I want to ask you about one specific scene that you mentioned in this book. It's in the elevator. So Archie's waiting for an elevator. He gets on. There's an African-American guy there, and then there's also a young Hispanic couple. The woman, the elevator gets stuck. The woman goes into labor, and Archie Bunker does what you think he would do, which is like, I'm not having anything to do with this. So let's roll that clip. It's All in the Family.
Oh, wow.
Ain't it supposed to cry or nothing? That sounds kosher.
Come see my son.
We got a little boy, you know.
He, obviously a very short snippet of a much more impactful scene, but you shot that whole thing tight on Carol O'Connor's face. Obviously not showing the baby yet. but you say that was the knockdown, drag-out fight you had with him. He refused to do that scene. So how do you handle that talent when you have to get him to creatively express this thing you've written?
It was either we do it or we don't do it. If we didn't do it, there would be no show. I wasn't coming back. The network wouldn't do the show if I wasn't coming back. Carol was faced with that ultimately. You know, it all sounds so much braver than in the telling than it really was at the time. We were all working to make a living. We were doing very damn well, but everybody was working very hard. To give a little bit about where you knew, if you lost this, you were going to lose the next 12.
Yeah.
It doesn't take that much effort or courage or anything else to say you're not talking about the one battle. You're talking about everything to come. And we were talking about creativity. Yeah. The first thing I would say to anybody entering a creative enterprise, writing, directing, acting, or something, stay with your conviction. You've got nothing better going for you than your gut.
How did you convince him that he could do that, though?
I didn't convince him. Well, he had to do it or everything was all over.
Huh.
He reached that moment. Now, I want to quickly say there was nobody. Week after week, what happened was, as often as not, he fought, didn't like, couldn't get through, wouldn't do it, and then passed through some membrane or phase or something, and out came Archie Bunker. And none of us could write the dialogue as well as he could just cough it up. They were the ideas of the writers. Everything was written. But when he became Archie Bunker, he was the best writer for the dialogue we had.
Huh.
And I could look at, you know, 3 hours of laughter in that show, and he could be responsible for 80% of it because of the way it came out of him. Huh. Not Carol O'Connor.
Right.
But the character.
What was it you said something about Archie Bunker. It was like he never knew what a moron he was, right? That was the beautiful part. He never knew what an idiot he was being.
Well.
And then that's why you like that character.
I just loved the jokes. Yeah. Just had such great jokes. Just joke after joke. I imagine the page count of, you know, like how
but
many
they
jokes.
Weren't. They were out of character.
No, well, but what I loved about so many of Norman's shows and what I like in the sitcoms or comedies is that every character speaks their own way. Too often shows all tend characters from the old grandmother to the young kid all speak like the writer.
Right.
Everybody talks like a bunch of 30-year-olds in a writer's room. And there was never a doubt as to what Archie or Edith or Meathead what they were going to say about something. There was never a doubt as to what their feeling about it was. And, like, you could picture what they were doing on the weekend. Hmm. They were truly realized characters that never spoke like the other. So it was just beautiful writing.
Yeah. You did for your the web series you do called Smart Girls, right? You have a group called Smart Girls that's all about encouraging women to be daring and creative and all of that good stuff, right?
Thank you.
You interviewed Irma Kalish,
yes,
who was a writer for Norman back in the day on All
I
in the
Family.
I
didn't hear the name.
Irma Kalish.
Irma Kalish.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Irma and your opening line was fabulous. You said your resume is the soundtrack of my childhood.
Yes, she wrote on Facts of Life, Maud, All in the Family, The Jeffersons, and six other amazing television shows that I watched my entire life.
The point being, you were running, I think, like 9 of the top 10 shows in network television, easily, you know, millions and millions and millions of people. You have two little kids. You're working Saturdays for 8 hours or whatever it is, SNL all night. The question is, how do you counter the fatigue and the stress and the anxiety that all of that brings to be creative? Or do you just not think and you do it? Or I can pick a new question.
Well, you know, everybody's tired.
Yep.
I mean, everybody's tired.
Yeah.
Right? If I asked you to raise your hand, I would say that everybody here is tired all the time. Deadlines are nice. Deadlines make you get things done creatively. I tend to work well with deadlines.
Here's also what she had going for her. It's Aristotle's definition, I think, of happiness. Happiness is the exercise of your vital abilities in along lines of excellence in a life that affords them scope. You're happy if you're doing your thing, reaching towards excellence, not necessarily achieving it, in a life that allows it. So for those hours, she was able to work with the kid, with a difficult economy, with all the problems in the world. She was making herself happy. And I think that's where that rests. That's what allowed her to do it in the midst of all that difficulty. I thought again and again as I was reading the book and realized you didn't write a lot about how difficult things were.
No, it doesn't help me to bemoan or complain.
That's not what you're doing, but
right? What I mean about creativity is interesting is it never helped me to talk about how tired I was.
Right.
I certainly do, and like everyone does, but it's in terms of being creative, I found that it got in the way the more I got in my head about that. And in the book I write very briefly about the difference between career and creativity, because creativity is loving your work, and I make the difference that creativity is like a warm, I picture it like a Hispanic woman who makes delicious food for me. And I don't know why, I just think she's Latina. And then she smells great, and she hugs me all the time, and she tells me I'm beautiful, and she makes me laugh, and she has a really young son that I get along with. And your career is like a bad boyfriend. Your career will never call you back. It flirts openly with other people. It's never going to marry you. It likes it when you ignore it. And those two things are very separate.
You both talk about...
I disagree with the woman.
All right, go ahead. So creativity for you is what?
No. I watch her work. She is fulfilling herself when she's working. You're doing everything you need to do for Amy Poehler when you're working. There are people who are not that way.
Can you be creative if you're working for somebody else? Not in the he's my boss, but in the I'm doing this for somebody else, right? You have to do it for yourself. Amy?
Oh, of course.
All right, just checking.
You could, absolutely.
Thought you were blowing me off.
No. I was getting worried that I was talking too much.
No, don't worry about it.
But I mean, she's working for somebody else in the sense that she gets a payroll.
Right. Yeah, of course.
She gets a check and so forth. But when she's in the character, she's working for the character. Yeah. It's just she and the character and the others she's interacting with. That's the world.
Yeah. Norman, did you guys have long hours in your writer's room? Like, were you an all-nighter kind of guy when you wrote?
It's crazy to say, I don't remember all-nighters.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there were some, but I don't remember them as a running thing.
Huh.
No. Huh. I remember sitting alone and writing that way into the wee hours.
Right. When you started managing those 4 or 5 or 9 or 10, whatever it was, shows, did you... You must have had to step back from the writer's room a bit, right? And you must have had to start managing. Did you miss being down there in the trenches with the gang?
I was in the trenches with All in the Family, Maud, Good Times the Jeffersons. Sanford and Son, I had very little to do with creatively except for falling in love with Red Fox.
Yeah.
But then it was made on the other side of the mountain in the valley, and Bud Yorkin had far more to do with it than I did. The other shows I did were all, I can put it this way, I had 5 families on CBS and 1 on Mooncrest Drive.
Yeah. You actually, I mean,
Which ones got me? Yeah. Which ones held me more?
Well, in the book, you are very wistful about not spending enough time with your family because you're with those other 5.
Well, it was. But I think doctors, lawyers, people who are working hard in any job are experiencing the same thing.
You actually, in the acknowledgments in this book, thank your drivers, the guys who drove you around L.A. and Hollywood in those days when you were doing 5, 6, 7, 8 shows.
Son of a gun, read the book.
Yeah.
I just read the acknowledgments. It's an old interviewer trick. You just read the acknowledgments. You both talk a lot about where you came from, about your upbringing. You talk a lot about your dad, who was an interesting guy. Who was taken away when you were 9 for 3 years and came back. You talk about life in Newton, Massachusetts. I wonder, and you must be able to because you wrote books about it, how you think that influences what you do or did creatively in your profession.
Norman? I grew up with, my parents were public school teachers, and I didn't know anybody who was an actor or writer. So that was I didn't know that world at all. So growing up in a very well-protected and loving, supportive, lower-middle-class home, very blue-collar home, there was a big sense that it was a nice mixture of my parents kind of telling me you can be whoever you want, but also a expectation that you have to work hard all the time. Yeah. So everybody worked really hard, and no one really had any money, and you know, it was that thing when no one really has any money, everybody knows how much money everybody makes.
Right.
Everybody knows how much money everybody has in the bank. Everybody talked about money all the time. It was like, how much did you pay for that refrigerator? How much is that car? What'd you get for that? Everybody knew what everybody's, you know, it's like, you know, he's getting paid $35,000 for that. You know, just the constant soundtrack of money. And you can either decide to have a bad or good relationship with money moving forward.
That was the biggest topic of conversation.
Yeah. Sure.
What could we afford?
Yeah. Certainly in your house, growing up in the Depression. Yeah, absolutely. Archie Bunker, you have said, bears no small resemblance to your dad.
Mm-hmm.
True?
In the sense that my dad called me the laziest white kid he ever met. And I would yell at him that he was putting down a whole race of people to call his son lazy, and he would say, that's not what I'm doing, and you're the dumbest white kid I ever met. So I grew up with that. The rest is, the rest is fabrication.
Yeah.
But the essence is that, and the volume.
Do you think All in the Family...
lived with endless volume, did you?
Yelling? I mean,
screaming, yes.
No, not crazy yelling, no.
When they got together, when the families got together at Thanksgiving or something, that the fact that Gert didn't invite Edna to the wedding 27 years ago? I mean, that kind of argument should have carried on for...
Your dad actually used to tell your mother to stifle, right? Just like Archie Bunker?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Jeanette, yeah. Stifle yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to play another clip here. It's from Saturday Night Live. You will recognize it instantaneously. It is our guest, Ms. Poehler, and one of her very famous impersonations.
Oh, so let's, boy. Let's roll that one. Oh, God, this can't be good.
No, it'll be all right.
But I still enjoyed that sketch a great deal.
I'm so good.
Because
look how good I am.
Because I simply adore Amy's impression of me.
Oh, well, my ears are ringing.
How are you?
Good, thank you.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, thank you for coming. I love your outfit.
Well, I love your outfit.
Why?
But I
thank you.
Do want the earrings back.
Oh, okay.
Do I really laugh like that?
Oh, yeah, well. Yeah.
So, that was benign and gentle, and obviously Hillary was in on the whole thing. But there's an element of what you do, and it happened in that race with Sarah Palin and Tina and all that stuff, where you are, you all right?
I have, I had a bad infection in this
hand.
Well,
let me help you out.
And this is good show business.
It is good show business. I'll be happy to open a bottle of water.
It's going to make Kai feel better. Like, he's going to feel really good about this.
Here we go. We're just going to open that up.
How simple that sounds.
All right.
Thank you.
There you go.
That's vodka, so make sure you.
Yeah, well, I'm bringing this one over.
Yeah.
So that one was fairly benign, right? But that whole race and the whole slew that you and Tina did with Sarah Palin and Hillary, it is social and political commentary, but it is, you say, really hard to do when you're standing right next to the person.
Yeah, so I say yeah. it's really weird to be dressed as someone standing next to them, no matter who they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, I mean, this is such an exciting time to be on that show because everybody was paying attention. And, you know, that I think we just kind of, we were doing the lines, but we were just kind of goofing around a bit. And it just goes to show how bad of an impression I did when you're standing next to the person. I'm like, I don't sound anything like her. What I liked about playing Hillary during those times, and Jim Downey, a terrific longtime writer on SNL, wrote most of those pieces, was finding a game. When you play a character and you don't do really, really good impressions like I do, you have to find a game, something they can play. And I liked Hillary's game, which was that she was actually a lot more fun and looser than people were letting her be.
Yeah.
And that I often found comfort in thinking that I, dressed as her, got to say things that she wished she could say.
Right. That's very meta, man. That's very...
Yeah, I mean, and it's very egotistical to insert myself into thinking that I am playing her id, but I did feel like there were times when I did.
Yeah. One more from Saturday Night Live. It's the 1976 season, which is, I think, their second one on the air. Mr. Lear is guest hosting, and he does a bit with his daughter, Kate, who is then, like, 19 years old.
Oh, it's no, much younger.
Well, look at her. She was 19. Anyway, no. We'll have a look. Anyway, I read the book, man.
Wasn't she younger?
Well, have a look.
That's
right. They're doing the bit. And anyway, so I want to play this tape. It's only a part of it, and then I want to ask you something.
I'm going to say to you, hello, Kate. You're going to say, hello, Mr. Lear. You're going to ask me, have I got any brothers? I say, yes, I have three brothers. You're going to ask me, are they all bald? And then I'm going to tell the joke. Have you got any brothers? Yes, I have three brothers. Are they all bald? Then I tell a joke.
Okay?
Okay, very simple. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Mr. Lear. Are they all bald?
Wait a second. Wait a minute. You put her up to it.
So she blows the joke, but that's not the question. The question, so right before that bit,
yeah.
Lorne Michaels had come up to you, the executive producer of Saturday Night Live, had come up to you and said, Norman, I'm really sorry. We need to cut your three brothers bit and move on. And you write, there were only a few rows of audience members I could see clearly, and among them sat my darling Kate looking up at me expectantly, her expression shouting, I'm here for you, Daddy, cue me. And of course I did. I cued my daughter as I shamefacedly fucked my producer. He accepted my apology at the same time, straining to understand. It's fascinating to me that you as a producer did that just because you wanted to get the bit on.
That's true, but you know what is even more fascinating, if I may?
Go to town. It's your interview. Go ahead.
That young woman's son, my grandson, is here tonight.
Oh, Daniel, that's awesome.
Where are you? Just your voice, Daniel.
Back there somewhere. What do you think? She was 19-ish, right?
I remember it so clearly. He said, cut it, and I fully intended to cut it. And I walked out in one, and as those things go, you don't see anything until you're there. And there, yeah, you know, three rows in is my daughter, and she's looking. And there was nothing else I could do.
I'm with you. Do you think, learn creativity, or is it something you just have?
Well, the word creativity is so broad. You know, there's all, I know that you can learn to become a better improviser, certainly a better stand-up. You can learn to be a better writer. I mean, I'm constantly learning and all the time. So, I mean, sure, the answer I would say is yes.
Norman?
I think there has to be a degree of creativity in every one of us, following different lines, infinite lines. And someone, I don't know who, once said, each man is my superior in that I may learn from him. And it's a degree of truth. I feel that way. I mean, mm-hmm. Stop and talk to anybody, and there's something there. Yeah. So I think creativity is experienced and expressed in an infinite variety of ways, and we're all capable of it.
This marks a moment in time for you, right? Parks and Rec is ending. You've got your book out. I'm sure you're going to do something else. Norman, in 1977, you basically said to all those 5-6 shows you're running, I'm done. Got to do something else with my life. How does it affect you in the present tense, and how were you thinking about the next creative thing you would do?
I'm very excited because I feel really fulfilled by what I've got to do these past couple of years. This chunk of 7 and 8 years has been really exciting, and I would have never predicted or seen what has come my way. Mm-hmm. So in that spirit, I'm keeping myself open to what's coming next. And I know it would be foolish to think I could see it yet. Yeah. So I'm really excited because I'm so much more ready for it than I was when I was younger. It's such a joy to get older.
Ooh,
and
say that
be
again.
It is. It's just, you know yourself better. You know, you don't take things so personally. You have these just unbelievably emulsified friends.
I don't know what that means. What does that mean?
Emulsification is when
I
you.
Know that.
Oh.
that I got. I can make a mayonnaise.
Have you heard of science?
Yes.
Okay.
I don't put my friends in blenders.
Emulsified friends meaning flavorful, juicy peers who are just like so concentrated. You know, it's like the reason why, you know, you have 10 bridesmaids when you're 25.
Yeah. Yeah. And now you're in touch with one.
You just don't when you're 45. Yeah. You just don't. You've gotten it together.
You were, Norman, in retrospect, a young man when you stopped doing television full time. You were like 57 or something, right?
I guess.
Well, so we'll go. It was 1977.
I don't feel that much older right now. That's the truth. Mm-hmm. I was surprised to hear myself say it, but it's basically the truth.
Well, and that comes through in the book, right? That you are still enjoying every single day. But if you'd known back then that you had 32 more years of every single day to deal with, would you have stuck around television longer?
You know, I find, as I look back, every 7 or 8 years or so, even within the industry, I did something different.
Yeah.
It was like a current running in me. It wasn't with conscious or forethought at all. And I feel that way now. I mean, you know, there are a number of nexts that I'm thinking about.
Do you think of yourself as a creative role model for people in television today?
No. I think I would have to be a very different person if I thought of myself as a creative role model.
All right. So I'm not just being rude here playing with my phone, but this woman tweeted at me today, and she said...
Congratulations.
I know. It was great. That's a whole different thing. It's a whole different thing. And she said, yada, yada, blah, blah, blah. P.S. We also just love Amy. She's pretty much who I want to be when I grow up.
Oh, she sounds lovely. You should take her out.
I totally should. what do kids say to you when you're out doing events or whatever it is?
Oh, it's really special. Norman and I were talking about this backstage. We've both got to go and visit cities and meet people and have exchanges with them. And it's really exciting to be around. I'm very inspired always by being around young people who are very, very unironic and very, there's just no sense of regret. Everything is in front of them and they like things very passionately and they have really black and white ideas and very strong opinions about things. And I just am lucky that, you know, talented, shy Asian girls like me. And, because they are the tastemakers. And don't you forget it, America. But they just say, I want to do what you do. I'm taking improv classes, or I love Leslie Knope, or whatever it is. And it's just really cool. It just completely always makes me feel really, really special. I think about what I was like at that age and how excited I would have been to meet somebody who inspired me.
Did you ever imagine that you'd be here doing this? Not this, but the big this. Did you ever imagine this would happen?
I don't think so.
Norman?
Here's how recently I've been surprised by who I am. I was in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago, and it was a book fest.
Yeah.
So I wasn't the only guy with a book. There were several other guys and a couple of women. Arianna Huffington had a new book she was on. So there were seven of us on the stage, sitting, waiting to be introduced, and we all read something from our books. And the fellow who was introducing us was introducing the seven authors on the stage to his right, and he named them, and he used the word author about 7 times, 10 times. And I've been a writer all my life. And now this guy is calling me an author. And I swear to God, I'm feeling more mature.
Ladies and gentlemen, the author Norman Lear and the author Amy Poehler. Thank you guys so much for your time. Thank you. Thank you so much.
I can't believe it's over.
Thank you. I told you it was going to go fast. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
I'm going to go out that way.
After you, madam.
'92, right? Come on. So that was The Business of Creativity from two people who clearly know what they're talking about. We're going to flip that coin now and look at the other side, and it's going to be the creativity of business. And we're going to do it with space rockets and Hollywood, all right? Gwen Shotwell is the president and COO of SpaceX, which is Elon Musk's other company besides the car one, right? They have, just to throw some numbers out at you here, $5 billion plus or minus in commercial space contracts, right? They run $1.5 billion contract with NASA to resupply the space station, which I think actually has gotten bigger recently. And it comes, our chat with her does, at a very interesting time, as we all know, tragically, in the commercialization of that space business model. So please, Gwen Shotwell.
RC, this is Rock on Countdown.net. Green screen.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And liftoff. Liftoff of the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, launching Dragon to the International Space Station and returning cargo resupply missions to U.S. soil.
Pretty cool, right? Okay, so Hollywood now, right? I know, exactly. Hollywood. This is actually an interesting weekend for Hollywood and space. Interstellar, anybody? Right? Show of hands. Worth my time? Ooh, no. Wow. No, seriously? I was totally looking forward to that. Yeah, my 13-year-old who's out there is going to be like, I told you, Dad. So, there are, I can't even tell you how many scripts floating around this town every single day, movie scripts, right? I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands, most of which never see the light of day. There are just too many of them. Our next and final guest for the evening, 10 years ago, founded something called The Blacklist, which was, at the time, an unscientific survey of the best unproduced movies of that year. It is now a going concern, a for-profit business, of which he is, again, still the founder and the CEO. It's called The Blacklist. His name is Franklin Leonard. Franklin, come on out. So,
oh, wow, look at that.
Those are just some of the films that have come off The Blacklist in the past 10 years. They've won, I don't run the numbers for me. I know you have them off the top of your head. Right? How many Oscar winners and how many this and how many that?
Yeah, so there have been almost 1,000 scripts on the list in 10 years. Yeah. I think 270 have been produced. They've made about $23 billion in worldwide box office. Been nominated for about 200 Academy Awards, winning 37, and 3 of the last 6 Best Pictures and 8 of the last 14 screenwriting Oscars. So, I think it's important to mention, though, that like we can't take credit for the success of those movies. Like, no, the people that make them deserve the credit.
Right, it's that whole light of day thing.
I think we serve to catalyze interest in them, and hopefully they go on to be made well, and I think we've created something of a virtuous cycle. But
Gwen Shotwell, does it bother you when the only time your industry is really in the spotlight, gets the light of day, is when things go wrong?
Well, you know,
it's almost routine, right? You guys go into the space shuttle to the space station every now and then.
Frankly, I think with SpaceX, we've had such kind of a great play with everyday regular folks that I think space is starting to become kind of more interesting and gets good press.
Yeah,
we are actually getting good press. Obviously, you have to cover the stories that occurred, you know, a week or two ago as well.
Yeah, I want to start with the idea of risk and failure, okay, which is something obviously you know a lot about in your business, your chosen field, but also I think applies in the Hollywood model, right? Because movies nowadays are expensive beasts. They take great time and energy. And so the question is, first of all, for you, Gwen, how do you make failure part of your creative process? How do you learn from failure?
So for sure in the development phase, failure is incredibly important. As a matter of fact, if you don't fail, you're not pushing yourself hard enough.
Right.
Failure when a customer is paying for your mission, however, is not an option.
I saw that movie too. Yeah. But it happens, right? I mean, you know.
It does happen, unfortunately. The rocket business is kind of a tough business. But you got 1 million pounds.
Have you ever actually said to anybody, no, come on, it's rocket science. It really is.
You know, I don't say that. I don't feel like a rocket scientist, but everyone says it for me.
All right, well, the actual rocket scientist.
Yeah.
What is the process by which, now that, explain how it started, right?
Yeah.
The Blacklist, and then I want to talk about it today as failure and risk.
So in 2005, I was working for Leonardo DiCaprio's production company. I was a junior executive, and my job, like it is for most junior executives, was to sort of consume as many screenplays, as many novels, as many video games. I guess breakfast cereals now would be viable too.
Yeah. It's a good job.
And sort of report back to my bosses, like, here's the stuff that's worth your time. These are the movies we should make.
Right.
And, you know, I had gone writing an excellent screenplay is a difficult thing. So I had gone months without reading something that I loved and felt comfortable walking into my boss's office and saying, this is it.
Right.
Like, don't do anything else tonight, read this. And so I was going on vacation for 2 weeks, and I knew I wanted to read some good scripts, and I sort of, I guess, defaulted from to some thinking that I had picked up in my brief stint as a management consultant, and took a survey of my peers and said, send me a list of your 10 favorite scripts from this year that haven't yet been made, and in exchange, I'll send you back the combined list. And I put a quasi-subversive name on it and sent it out and went on vacation, didn't think anything of it. And when I came back, it had been forwarded back to me several dozen times, and it sort of became a thing very quickly. And then this was sort of in the early days of, like, internet virality, so it was still sort of a new thing. But obviously, the internet has sort of flown forward, and we've had to try to adapt to that.
When was the moment when you knew you had a business, where this creative process was going to turn into a business?
We should probably talk in 10 years when I know for sure.
Well, but you're the CEO now, man.
Yeah,
it says right there on the website.
You know, I'll be honest with you. I think of what we do less as a business than as a mission, if that makes any sense, and it doesn't sound too cloying. You know, our what we do, and when I say we, there's a sort of team of us now. Yeah. I have a business partner, Dina Siamich, who handles all the tech stuff, and a great team of folks, Terry Huang, Kate Hagen, Megan Halpern, and our blogger, Scott Myers. You know, we sort of see our role as identifying and celebrating great screenwriting and facilitating that writing, making it to the screen. Right. And so I think it's an ongoing process of for us in terms of making it a viable business. I think we have something that sort of functions now. There are a lot of other things we want to do with it, but really the mission is far important, more important for us than the sort of business model is right now.
Yeah, the mission. I mean, you guys have two kinds of missions, right? You have the actual mission of going up in space, but there's this larger thing that SpaceX is trying to do.
Yeah, we have these crazy audacious goals, and the company was founded fundamentally to change the business or the value proposition of human transport into space. So really what we're focused on now is doing a great job for our customers, but building up enough revenue and having enough money to develop the capability to take people to Mars.
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 If Elon came to you and said, do you want to go? What would you say?
So I don't like to camp. And
all right,
and
if
early
they had
on,
a habitat.
Early on, Mars is going to be camping.
Yeah.
So I think there are people far better suited than me to do that initially.
Yeah.
You know, but when the first Holiday Inn Express shows up, maybe I'll go.
It's interesting that you are in this business of which you don't necessarily want to partake.
Well, I'd love to go to space.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would love to peek out of a giant window from Dragon and look back at the Blue Marble. There's no question I'd love to do that. But that's different from an 8-month trip in a bus with the same 100 people.
Yeah.
Not stopping at 7-Eleven for your Slurpee.
Yeah, yeah.
You're on that bus, and you're heading to Mars. And what happens if you get there and you don't like it?
Yeah, it's 8 months back.
There's no Uber back. Well, you can get back on the spaceship and go back.
Elon will figure it out. What about you, actually, as long as we're on this participatory thing? You're in the movie business, but you're not making movies.
No,
any,
not yet.
Any desire to exercise that creative side of your business?
Yeah, I mean, I came to Los Angeles 11 years ago now because I wanted to be involved in making movies. I looked at movies like Being There and Amadeus and Dr. Strangelove, and those are the things that, like, if I can be a part of seeing things like that get made, then absolutely. And I think that we play a role in that, and I don't think I need to be on set or have my name on the screen in order to feel like we're a part of seeing great stories being told.
Yeah. You both had careers in other fields before you found what you are doing now and have been doing for a long time. You were a consultant at McKinsey.
That's right.
For a while, and you were at GM and also with the government, with the National Reconnaissance Office, right?
I was with Chrysler Motors.
Sorry, Chrysler.
That's right.
You know, they all run together, whatever.
And I was with a consulting firm that basically worked for the Air Force and NRO.
How did that change your approach to what you do now in business creativity? Gwen, go ahead.
Oh, can you get me to go first?
All right. She told the good space story. You're up.
Yeah, I can't really compete with the space thing. I think for me, you know, right out of college, I sort of did three different things very quickly. I ran a congressional campaign in Ohio or helped run a congressional campaign. I was a writer for a newspaper in Trinidad. And then I was at McKinsey for 2 years. And I think some of that was just sort of me trying out different things and being like, nope, that's not it. Let me try the next thing. Mm-hmm. And I think I probably picked up different sort of modes of thinking and sort of approaches to different systems. And I've never been one to sort of very dogmatic about, oh, well, the way things have always been done is the way things should be done. And I think I probably brought a lot of different approaches from previous jobs into, you know, the environments and jobs that I've had now and said, well, what if we did things this way? Why aren't things done this way? And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Right.
Sometimes there is a reason why things have always been done this way.
Which actually brings me to the rocket scientists, right? I mean, these guys have checklists and they are engineers, so they think like this. Does that impede you as you try to get them to think, listen, we need to figure out a way to make this rocket 47 pounds lighter?
Actually, engineers are incredibly creative people. I mean, that's what engineering is.
Yeah. That'll
we
show me.
We have a house full of engineers. How awesome.
That's right.
Well done.
You're a draw, actually, is the deal.
So engineers are incredibly creative. That's what engineering is. It's creating things. And so I don't feel like I've ever had to, like, push my team to go think of bigger and better things. It's kind of what they do naturally. Engineers are driven to do things better, really to the point of being annoying a lot of times, actually.
Yeah, I'm not hearing a lot of applause for that, by the way, from the engineers out there. Does it bother you, Franklin, that you are dependent on, almost by definition, creative types, right? The people who write the scripts that go to the blacklist, the people who review them, the people who comment on them, the people who eventually produce them. You're a little bit at their mercy in your business model now?
I mean, I think, look, I think I came to Hollywood to be at sort of the mercy of creative types. I mean, I sort of idolize creative types, particularly writers. I mean, I like to joke that literally this entire enterprise is just so I can hang out with screenwriters.
Huh.
And arguably, mission accomplished. I find people, and I include engineers in this category, people who are sort of involved in creative problem solving, whether it be sort of narrative creative problem solving or how do I take human beings to Mars and allow them to live there and make it back. I think people that sort of think in those terms and are sort of constantly processing questions like that are some of the most interesting people in the world. And so I'm sort of happy to be at their mercy and really proud of it, honestly.
Do either of you worry that as you get bigger and you become the establishment, right? Yeah, you know where I'm going. As you become the establishment, you will lose a little bit of that, not the startup mentality, which we'll get to in a minute, but a little bit of that creative spark, and we got to figure out how to do it better, and we got to do this. Because, you know, in 5 years, you're going to be a studio, for crying out loud, and you're going to be running things to the space station every Tuesday.
There is always that concern that first, as you grow, we've grown incredibly fast, but as you grow, you put in more bureaucracy in place,
yeah.
and you know, we were always trying to rip bureaucracy out, but you know, my boss, Elon, it would be a terrible day if we weren't creating something new every day, and that's really his job, is to really get folks thinking about what is the next best thing, how are we going to do this thing better so that we can get to Mars.
What's your job?
My job is to make that okay.
With all those engineer types.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Same basic question, though, right? I mean, yep. you now, I mean, the blacklist is an open thing. It's not a secret anymore. You're you know, there was a point where the LA Times, like, outed you for being the head of the blacklist.
That is true.
It was a big
deal. I think it's, for me, it's about sort of me personally remaining focused on that mission and not on the business. But I actually think that probably the most important thing is who you surround yourself with. And I think, you know, I've always joked that probably if I have any talent at all, the only talent that I have is hiring good people. And I think that for me, it's about having a team of people who keep you honest and sort of keep you on track as well.
Yeah.
And I've got a great group of folks who, you know, if we start drifting, will not hesitate to tell me that I've lost my damn mind. And that's their job, frankly. And some of them are here tonight. So, I think that's the best thing. I think that's basically what you're saying, right? Is like you keep people around you that are there for the same reasons that you are when you start, and you make sure that if you do start to drift away from that mission, that there are people who feel empowered to come and say, this is not what we said we exist to do. And maybe we're no longer doing that anymore, but let's have that discussion and acknowledge that we've made that shift. Or let's return to the original course.
Right. I'll ask you guys the same question I asked Norman and Amy. Do you think you can learn creativity? And obviously it's a different ball game for the two of you than it is for them, right? Gwen?
I think you can be taught kind of the definitely you're taught the engineering process, which I guess is a process of creativity. So, yeah, I think you can be taught that. Hmm. Whether you could do it well is a different issue.
Right. And you are, we should say, you're a mechanical engineer and,
yes.
And what? Applied mathematics is the other.
Correct. Yeah. Which is engineering analysis.
Okay. I'm like a history political science guy. I don't know anything about that stuff. What do you think?
I hate this question because I never feel like I have a good answer for it. I think, yes, you can teach creativity. And I think on some level that teaching is about removing assumptions, like sort of decalcifying the brain, right? Like I think mm-hmm. like all kids are really creative. Like I've never met a child right. who is not really creative. And I think on some level, as we grow older, we take certain things for granted and we assume certain things that certain things aren't possible and that things can only be done a certain way. And so a lot of it is like, I think getting back to being a little bit more childlike and sort of allowing yourself to believe that anything's possible. And then it's just a matter of mm-hmm. figuring out how to do that. But ask me tomorrow and I'll have a completely different answer. So,
well, okay. I mean, we'll rent a different hall, but yeah, sure. When you bring new people on, how do you maintain that spirit of startup mentality and entrepreneurialism, which clearly you're still in the midst of, but yeah. SpaceX has like 3,000 people.
Almost 4,000.
Almost four. So how do you do it?
You know, the place has a great buzz about it.
Well,
it still feels
because they're making rockets.
We're making rockets. We're making rockets and spaceships.
I took a tour actually with her boss, and we had him on the show, Elon. And it's just cool.
It's super cool, yeah. actually. Yeah. So we're doing cool things. It's got a great buzz. People are energetic about what they're doing. The folks that come in want to be part of it. They want to be part of the mission. They want to go put their hands on the rocket. So right. it's actually still has a startup feel to it. I mean, there's things that need to get fixed. You know, yeah. there's, you know, the bureaucracy that creeps in that you got to yank out. But I think for a 4,000 or just under 4,000 person company, it feels like a startup.
I imagine you're hiring not just engineers, but HR types and operations analysis people. I mean, you need everything to get this thing going.
You do need everything, but That's pretty lean at SpaceX. We've learned how to do that pretty leanly. The majority of the staff, the vast majority of the staff, engineers and technicians.
Yeah. Well, speaking of lean, tell the story about, I guess you built the Falcon for $400 million, $4 million, whatever it was.
Yeah, Falcon 9 was about $400 million.
And somebody from the government told you that if NASA had built it itself, it would have been?
Like $3 billion.
Yeah. Billion with
three
a B.
To $4 billion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why?
Well... A couple of things. First of all, when we built this rocket to our own requirements, we could trade requirements. Huh. If one piece wasn't working out well, maybe we could make up for it in another subsystem. If you're building a rocket for a customer, like the customer's paying you to build that rocket as opposed to developing it yourself, every time you want to change something, you got to go back to the customer and do mother may I, and then they have to process it. So the feedback loop, right. the design loop and the engineering loop is much slower. And time is money, so that makes it more expensive. In addition, at SpaceX, we design, analyze, and build and test almost the entire vehicle ourselves, like the vast, vast majority of it. So you're not using lawyers to subcontract to vendors who struggle on their own, and then their part doesn't exactly fit. You know, if something doesn't work or fit on the rocket, you know where that engineer is, and you march over to the cube, and you're like, what did
get
work?
Get creative right now. Who are your customers for the blacklist?
Well, for the business, it's screenwriters from all over the world, really. Yeah. Now, anyone who's written an English language screenplay can upload their script to the site, host it there, have it evaluated.
Right. For a nominal fee.
For a nominal fee, yeah. $25 a month to host the script, and then $50 to have a screenplay evaluated, and $30 to have a 30-minute or less episodic pilot evaluated. And if it's evaluated positively, we tell the entire industry, and we make recommendations to film and television industry professionals that based on their taste, they may also like these scripts that they were previously unfamiliar with. Right. I mean, one thing that we're really trying to do is create a more efficient marketplace for material. which is, you know, evaluating material is a pretty resource-intensive process. And like you said, there's a super abundance of material out there. Right. So to the extent that we can make that process more efficient, that's part of what we're trying to do.
His mention of the marketplace brings up a very interesting question. So the government just did a whole big space contract thing with you and Boeing, right? Who else is out there that you're worried about? Other than NASA, who are your customers? What is your marketplace?
So our marketplace is anyone that wants to put a satellite in orbit or put cargo or astronauts on the space station. So we have international government customers, and then there's also commercial providers, folks that, you know, have telecommunications or telecommunications operators, and they need their satellites put into space. So there's that. Once we've developed the capability to take people into space, the market changes drastically.
Right.
It's no longer governments only. Then it's a much broader marketplace.
Well, now explain that a little bit, right? Because it's especially in the wake of what happened with Spaceship Two, right? We're not popping you up to the atmosphere and bringing you back down, right? You're gonna take somebody somewhere?
This would be orbital. Yeah, we do orbital. Wow. Orbital space flight. So we'd take someone to a destination in low Earth orbit, a little bit further, ultimately Mars. And then hopefully after that, even further.
Yeah, yeah. You keep saying that, Mars.
We're Mars people.
I'll get off this kick in a minute. How long until you get people up in the space? How long until you're carrying people?
A couple years.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's cool. That's cool.
You know, the Americans can't take their own astronauts right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, no, that's, yeah.
It's like a national tragedy.
Yep.
Yeah.
You were employee number 7 at SpaceX, right?
Correct. Okay. 007.
007. Nice. At what point did you realize, and maybe clearly you realize it when you joined, but humor the spirit of the question. Did you realize that Elon wasn't screwing around, that this was actually going to be a going concern?
I knew that Elon wasn't screwing around right at the beginning. I wasn't sure we were going to be successful. I had been in the industry for 15 years or so when I joined SpaceX. I think, about 15 years. And it's a hard business, and I had not seen a truly commercial operator or new entrant really mm-hmm. make it. So it was kind of risky, but it was absolutely what I intended to do. I was frustrated at the pace of innovation. Well, there was frankly not much innovation in the industry at the mm-hmm. time. And the cost of launch is so high that if we didn't go fix that problem, then space is never really going to get interesting. It will kind of remain in the constipated era that it was.
So we know what the disruption of the blacklist is, right? It's that crowdsourcing of it and then developing the business model from that and then getting the people to pay attention. What was the creative disruption for SpaceX?
It was enormous. It was an industry that was kind of mired in bureaucracy, lacked innovation. Things cost way too much. They take way too long. And so we break into the market and develop rockets at a tenth or more of what others have done, which really changes the entire value proposition of putting things in space. And people were angry about that.
Well, explain that a little bit.
Yeah,
it's tough to be creative in the face of people, you know, saying lousy things about
you
in the press.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, it's an entrenched industry. It's been safe for the big players up till now.
Right.
Yeah. It's awesome.
I want to return really quickly to the idea of the startup mentality. When will you guys know, and you're in different phases of the business evolution here, right?
I mean, we are sending people to Mars. But
That's true. Yeah. Well
got
done.
News for you.
I didn't mention that.
We got
it's
news
happening
for
next
you.
Week. So.
Yeah. When are you not going to be a startup anymore?
I mean, I hope we're always sort of a startup, right? Like, I mean, a startup is a state of mind, I guess, would be, if I'm going to reference being
it's
there.
It's a song, dude.
No, but I think a startup, and again, I'm saying things that I'm sure I may regret or may want to edit tomorrow, but I think the idea of a startup is really a mentality. It's about sort of an intensity of churn and a belief in innovation and a belief in sort of constantly self-questioning and constantly sort of building on what you've created and not really being tied to, again, any sort of legacy that deserves respect just for its existence. And I think if that is the startup mentality, I hope we stay a startup forever. But again, I may not feel that way tomorrow.
Yeah, which is your prerogative, right, as the boss.
Yeah.
When you're having your one-on-ones with Elon, whenever that is, probably
I just had one
every
yesterday.
Freaking day, probably. How much do you talk about the idea of being as creative as you possibly can?
Most of my interactions with or discussions with Elon are more about the business.
Yeah.
He kind of runs the development team, and I run the day-to-day stuff. I mean, clearly we want to make sure that we're setting up the business and the infrastructure that will promote creativity and innovation. So
is there going to be a day, what's the day going to be where you say, my work here is done?
My work here is done at SpaceX?
Yeah.
I can't imagine ever fully leaving SpaceX.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's a lifestyle.
Yeah. What about you?
It's really hard for me to imagine being able to say, okay, done here and moving on. I mean, I know when we're moving in the right direction, right? Like I think when screenwriters are sort of receive the notice and are sort of acknowledged for the value that they bring to the table within the film industry, I think that will be significant progress. But I don't know that there's a point at which I'll be able to say, no, I'm good. Time to not have this as a preoccupation.
Yeah. Do you have to be preoccupied to be creative? Do you have to be preoccupied to have that drive?
I would think you have to be pretty driven.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know that I totally agree. I think that there are people who are creative in moments that aren't sort of overwhelmingly preoccupied with sort of processing. Oh, there's the creative moment. I think preoccupation is a trait that a lot of highly creative people have, but I don't know that they're necessarily one-to-one.
All right. I'm going to Mars. Franklin Leonard and Gwen Shotwell. Thank you guys so much. Thanks.
Fun.
Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, man.
So the truth is, there's actually no magic that happens when I say, let's do the numbers, right? Although if you were on the ball, you'd have hit it right there, but she didn't. It's a gimmick, right? It's a device we use so that we can unpack some of the stuff that happens in this $17 trillion thing that we call the American economy. Because if there's anything we've learned, as Deb said at the beginning, if there's anything we've learned in the last 6 years of this economy, it's that if you're not paying attention, bad things will happen. Economic growth in this country and in the world is fundamentally a creative process, right? Higher GDP, innovation, development, going to Mars, writing a script, being funny, take your pick. It's fundamentally a creative process. And we do hope that we left you a little bit of that tonight. We thank you for your time, and we thank you for coming.